I don't need my mom to be my best friend who sits there and complains with me about how awful the world is right now. You know, what I need, and I think what so many other people need from white people, is for them to engage with whiteness.
Maladjusted Life Podcast, James Murray here. Today, my guest is the New York Times bestselling author, Ijeoma Oluwa. Her book, So You Want to Talk About Race, is the topic of our discussion, and race in general. Ijeoma, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I met you, what month was that? I met you in, say, April, this past April, at the Arkansas Literary Festival. I kind of took up an inordinate amount of your time talking to you, but we had a very good discussion, and I was like, I wanted to continue that. Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to get you as a guest on my show ever since, and here we are. So I guess I want to start off by asking you, so you want to talk about race, your book. I mean, obviously the topic is about race. I guess I want to start off by asking, racially, how do you identify?
I identify as a Black woman, or if to be more specific, a mixed race Black woman.
Black woman. Okay. Do you think, what are, I mean, obviously you saying that you're a mixed race black woman, one obviously has a mixed heritage. Other than that, what kind of distinction do you think separates, say a mixed race Black person and a person who's identifies as Black, but not mixed race? Like in terms of privileges, in terms of lived experiences, do you think are some big differences?
You know, I would say a lot of it ends up, it really depends. Mm-hmm. You know, my sister is also mixed race Black woman. Mm-hmm. She's much darker than me. She's not someone I think anyone who encounters her would ever guess she was mixed race. So she walks through the world a bit differently than I do. I'm very visibly mixed race. I'm very visibly Black and very mixed race. And then there are some people who are mixed race and not visibly Black. And some people who aren't even visible, who look white, but they're half Black. I would say that because race is really about visual distinction, but also culture, history, heritage at the same time, mm-hmm. ends up being how you walk through the world. There are some very specific experiences, I think, for mixed race Black people. Some are challenges. There's a ton of privilege, and a lot of it ends up being how you look, how your household environment ended up shaking out, mm-hmm. All sorts of things. So for me personally, I am a light-skinned Black woman. I wouldn't say I'm extraordinarily light-skinned, but I'm definitely light-skinned to have quite a bit of privilege, especially someone who talks about race mm-hmm. differently. The darker skin Black people, especially darker skin Black women.
Right.
I grew up in a majority white environment, which had its challenges.
The Pacific Northwest, correct? Is
that it? Yes. Okay. In Seattle. I grew up in Seattle. Seattle, I believe, for most of my life has been the fifth whitest major city in the country. Mm. So it has its own set of challenges, but also I would say, when it comes to talking about race, I'm heard differently because I talk differently. I talk like someone who grew up in this area. I didn't really have any financial privilege or anything like that. We grew up, I was on welfare, no electricity, mm-hmm. Eaten in churches my entire life. But I would say that I occupy a unique space. It's not one I like to fetishize. It's one that I find there is often a lot of pressure to fetishize. But it has a lot of, I would say, more privileges than outweigh challenges when it comes to what Black people face.
Right. So more privileges relative to Black people.
Yes.
Yeah.
To darker people. Yes.
Darker skinned Black people. Another reason I asked that question is because my girlfriend is actually a biracial Black woman as well. And one thing I noticed, most of her friends are, the majority of her friends are white. One thing I've noticed is that and she's told me this. I think a lot of them have her friends feel comfortable talking about race in a way with her that I don't necessarily feel like they would say to somebody that looks like me. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason I want, one reason I think for that is, I mean, not only because of the physical appearance, whatever, but also because of that relationship she has to white people in her family. Mm-hmm. Like, she has a white mother, right? And I think because of that, maybe they feel like she can empathize with them or relate to them in a certain way that I wouldn't be able to.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I feel like they may be able to crack a joke around her, a racial joke around her, because, like, oh, well, she's half of one of us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just bullshit like that. But I've always wondered about, because I'm going to ask you about your mother in a minute, because I know you talk about her a little bit in your book. This concept just kind of like divided loyalties,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense to you. From my experience dealing with biracial people who classify themselves as Black, I get this sense that they see themselves as Black because that's how society treats them. I mean, society lets them know that they're not white.
Yes.
But white people have let them know that they're not white.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you can have people within Black America too seeing them as distinct as well, as their own distinct group as well. So they don't really kind of, I really don't feel like they fit in anywhere to some extent. Have you ever felt that sense of division or just this split?
I've had a lot of time to think about this throughout my life. I mean, my brother and I grew up kind of alone. There weren't many Black kids at all. Mm-hmm. So then you become, when there's no other Black kids to compare you to, you're just Black.
Mm-hmm.
There's no mm-hmm. kids. Like, people, white America loves to play Black people off against each other. But
right.
whenever these two brown kids, they become the Blackest Black kids in the entire neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So from our childhood till probably about fifth grade, that's kind of how we were perceived in a lot of spaces. Then when we got into like middle school years and things like that, there were more Black kids, and suddenly we were shifted into this kind of ambiguous space. I would say that there is something really abusive that happens to a lot of mixed race Black people. We talk about kind of divided loyalties, but I don't even think it is divided loyalties.
Mm-hmm.
There's a space that is that mixed race people are pushed into, and it starts early, and it starts with things like the jokes you were talking about.
Right.
Those jokes are abusive. They're a way of saying, let me see how much you can take. And it sets up your relationship with white America as, you will be the one to absorb any of my missteps. You will be the one to absorb my insensitivities, my discomforts with the fact that you're in my space. And a lot of times they view light-skinned Black people and mixed-race Black people as the people who are going to absorb the brunt of like all of that, and will be their friend that they can feel comfortable saying something racist around and do all these things. And it's the only space, like, they kind of view like, they, like, they're offering you this olive branch, this middle section, but it's really just a place where you're just kind of this person that absorbs all of their racial tension and grossness. And they think that that's closeness, because a lot of white America envisions, when you ask a lot of white people, like, what they envision racial harmony, it's live the way they've always lived. They magically have Black friends. And I think a lot of times they test that on mixed race Black people because they feel like they're closer to them,
yeah, or
they will want to be in that world. And so they're saying, you know, I'm going to give all of these jokes. I'm not going to, our definition of friendship and our definition of you belonging is, you're going to bear the brunt of every, you know, comment I have to make and all of this stuff. And you're going to smile. And then you're part of, you know, you're let in a little bit. It happens to me a lot. I actually get super offended because a lot of times I know it's because of how I appear. Mm-hmm. People come up to me and say something, and I'm just like, oh, you thought, you know, like you thought you could get Well, you thought I had made this deal with you that I didn't make. But I know a lot of people who make those deals, and I don't judge them. I don't judge Black people, mixed race Black people who have, because the pressure is immense, because you're told from the moment you're born, especially often by white parents, that you're the bridge, that you're the person that's going to bridge these two worlds, that you're going to carry all of that. And it's abusive. And I see it time and time again, and it hurts my heart. I meet so many mixed race Black people who are fundamentally damaged in their 40s and 50s. When I start talking about this, just start bawling, because they have never lived a day in white or Black America as their whole selves, because pushed into this role as this bridge. And I'm not trying to be like poor, tragic mulatto, right? Like, you get a ton of benefits. You get access that helps you financially, helps you as far as your safety. But the psychic toll is immense. Yeah. And I see it all of the time. And there's a lot of pressure to be that person. And people, you walk in a room and people just automatically assume that's who you'll be.
I mean, from your description of what biracial Black people have to go through, they almost seem to serve as a buffer group between Black and white people. And because white Americans, you know, I guess in some sense see them as somewhat closer to them than, say, Black Americans, that, you know, they're getting the brunt of how they feel about Black Americans, right? This mixed group is getting, they're being used as a punching bag to some extent as to how they feel about Black Americans, because they're not necessarily, maybe not necessarily physically close to them. They may be, say, afraid to say these things around them. But yeah, they're getting the brunt of it. I never really thought about it like that.
I've been told so many times, you're not, you know, people will say something so racist to me, and they'll go, oh, well, but you're not really Black. It's okay. You know, and they'll say that, and they feel like they can kind of test it out on you. And then they'll feel less bad about these awful thoughts that are in their head, because they said it to a person of color, but not someone they view fully Black. And they feel almost like that little weakness part of you is going to agree, you know, and then they get off the hook, and they don't have to feel guilty, and they don't have to feel racist for these awful racist things that they're saying. And really, you know, it's just, it's because at the same time, it's so incredibly racist to think that a Black person would be that to you. That's what they're there for, that's what we exist for, to make you feel better about how racist you are, you know, and you feel like white supremacy isn't as bad as it is. And that being said, of course, the most violent of white supremacy often falls upon the people that white people are more afraid of or think even less of, and that's often darker skinned Black people. It's more of a day-to-day, you know,
microaggressions and
all
that
all the time.
So getting into your mother, like I said, this situation is sort of relatable from my personal experience. Being a biracial person and having a white parent, particularly a white mother who doesn't quite get it, I've had talks with my significant other about her mother. And I was like, you know, I was asking, like, who do you go to when you, like, who did you go to as a child when you experienced, you know, this act of racism? Could you talk to your mom about it? And she's like, no, I couldn't talk to, like, I guess she had to talk to her dad about it. Or, but to me, that's, I don't want to say sad, but it's just, I feel like one should be able to talk to a parent about that, both parents. And I want to sound overly judgmental right now, but I feel like if you are a white person bringing in a child of color into this world, and you can't talk about racism, you don't really need to be having a child of color.
I mean, I don't think you're being overly judgmental at all. I've seen what it looks like. I've seen the immense damage done. Kids of color, you know, any kids of color, honestly, because I run into, you know, Latinx kids raised by white parents, Asian kids raised by white parents, think that their love transcends race.
Right.
Have to talk, and they forget that white is default, and they completely erase this important part of their kid's identity. And I've seen grown adults just try to even ask me about it and break down crying. it does so much damage to people. Your parents are supposed to see you, you know? They're supposed to see you and love all of you. And if you can't acknowledge and be there for them and know that there is a part of their world that you aren't going to know firsthand, but you got to try to see and be there, listen and learn. And, you know, I think so often parents, white parents of kids of color, think that they should never have to make themselves feel uncomfortable. They think they can bring a kid of color into their world.
Mm-hmm.
And that kid will flourish. They don't think about that kid's world. They don't think about bringing themselves into their kid's world. I know so many white parents of kids of color who have no black friends, you know, have no black community. And they think that their kid will just flourish somehow in this all white space.
Hmm.
And the thought of making themselves uncomfortable and finding black community, finding community for their kids, finding culture for their kids, finding a sense of place for their kids is something unheard of to them. They think kids are accessories to bring into their lives. And it's incredibly damaging. And I think that I would tell any parent, like, if they're not hearing from their kids, if you are a white parent of a kid of color and you are not hearing about your kids' struggles, about how they feel about their identity, it's not because that kid's doing good. It's a warning sign. That kid doesn't feel safe talking to you. And they're bearing the whole brunt of that on their own because it is hitting every kid. I don't know a single black kid where race didn't hit them. And I certainly don't know a single black kid raised in a white environment was it hitting them every single day. Mm. And none of them tell their parents. None of them feel safe telling their parents. And if you think your kid is doing great because you haven't heard anything, your kid is not. Mm. And that's just the story of America. And your kid isn't doing great.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not hearing, you should be so concerned.
Could you tell me, like, any specific instance in your, I guess, your life, young adult life or life as a child, when you kind of realized that your mother didn't quite get what you were going through?
You know, I think there were a lot of times where I would say I'm lucky in some ways in that my mom at least acknowledged our blackness, and which so many kids of color don't get from white.
Right. True.
At all. They try to act like it doesn't exist. My mom, I think, spent a lot of time trying to prepare for, like, some, like, super violent racist act, right? You know what I mean? Because a lot of white America thinks racism is only that. There's so many times where I remember thinking, you know, someone would say something at school, you know, or even when I talk about in the book, like, that bus full of kids shout, you know, calling my brother and I nigger.
Mm-hmm.
And then having to deal with all these horrible aggressions from the white people we're staying with the whole time. There were so many times where you think, I'm not going to tell my mom because either she's going to make this the biggest deal ever, or she's just not going to know what to do with it. And it's just going to make her sad. I think there was kind of this realization, I think a lot of kids of color with white parents have, that they know that their parents are just not going to know what to do with those emotions. They're not going to know relate, and they're not going to know how to support. And so you make a decision,
mm-hmm.
not tell them. And that was more than anything what we did. You know, like, my mom would always talk about, my mom has some weird rules. And, like, she had this rule, anyone ever called us a nigger, we had to fight them. That was a rule.
You had to.
Yeah. Hmm. Like, wow. My mom had this weird, like, you know, violence is wrong, never hit anyone. But if anyone calls you a nigger, and, like, she would have people teach us how to, like, hit. Like, she was like, you're going to fight them.
Mm.
And I don't think, you know, I think she was trying to teach us, like, that we, you know, that was worth fighting about, you know. She wanted in some way to make us feel like, you know, she would have our backs.
Mm-hmm.
All it did was it just kind of made this whole, like, we had this one extreme reaction that wasn't helpful. Like, when a whole bus load of kids called you, you're just, my brother and I were talking about that. He was like, that was the first time that ever happened to me. I can't fight all those kids. It's like, right. What can you do? You know, right. So you just sit there like, well, now what? You know? And I don't think she knew anything else. You know, I don't think she knew, like, really about, like, you know, the emotional toll day in and day out and how to prep us for that. And so you just kind of went like, well, this isn't this category and it's not this. We're just going to try to absorb it. And I always knew it would make my mom very sad if she knew. And I knew that she wouldn't really know what else to do other than be sad. And that wasn't helpful to me. So,
And nowadays, now that you are Now that you're a well-noted writer, what does your mom think about your thoughts on race?
Oh, she, you know, it's really funny because I think at first it was really uncomfortable for her in a way that she wasn't prepared for. You know, I think that so many white parents have this kind of illusion that they have transcended race because they raised kids of color, especially if you like raise somewhat successful kids of color, that you won, you know, you're the dream. Mm-hmm. You know, and my mom really thought for a long time that, you know, she had kind of transcended whiteness because so much of her life was dedicated to us. You know, my mom was a single parent and lived and breathed my brother and sister and I, like our life and our health, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that that for her, that meant because she was so invested in us that somehow she had magically become part Black herself. Mm-hmm. And she hadn't. And so I think that, like, it was interesting when I started writing and she started realizing that my Blackness was different than what she had envisioned for me. Hmm. It was different than what she knew, you know, that it, there was a space in it that she couldn't touch. It was really kind of threatening for her. So she never talked to me a lot about my writing. She would kind of occasionally scan things like a mom does, but she wouldn't really read my articles. You know, I think it was scary for her. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we had the conversation I talked about in the book, and that was a tough conversation, that she really had the face that I was, that there was a gap between us, and she was actually white, and that meant something. And it meant that there was a huge part of my life that she was going to relate to differently, that she wouldn't be able to relate to at all, and that her role in my life as a parent and her ability to empathize and all those things were different than what she had been raised to expect when she had kids, you know, because I think you're raised to think you're going to love your kids. They come from you. They are a part of you. You know them better than you know yourself. But when you have kids of a different race, you don't. Mm-hmm. And so it was really tough at first. I would say I'm so proud of her. I think like right now she's such an example that I like to show people because my mom is, you know, she's going to be 64 years old. Mm-hmm. A lot older than I think a lot of people think that white people can start learning new things when it comes to race. And watching her try to figure out what whiteness means, like, you know, she had a little anecdote. She went to she's really big in unions, right? Mm-hmm. She's been a union leader for a long time. She went to a national union meeting and she was at this bar. My mom's a notorious lightweight. Mm-hmm. She was at the bar, and there was this white guy talking about all this work he's doing with, you know, quote unquote, like inner city youth, right? And so she hears this guy, he's talking very condescendingly about how he's saving these kids, mm-hmm. all this stuff. And so my mom was like, you know, he was talking nonstop and couldn't hear anything. She's like, but you know what I figured out? He's not going to tell an old white lady to shut up. So I got a whole drink and I sat down next to him and I just talked for like an hour about how he needs to be reaching out to other Black people and talking to them and ask what they really want and how condescending he sounds. And it's just like, mm-hmm. like hearing her finally recognize, oh, I'm a white woman and I'm actually white. And so this means that instead of like complaining to like another Black person, did you see how racist this white guy was? No, I'm going to sit and know that because I'm white. He's not going to, and I'm an old white lady. He's not going to tell me to shut up. Mm-hmm. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to try to like get him to actually talk to some Black people and maybe not be such an asshole. Like she does that, and she does this in her union meetings. Like she's always like, you know, she's more aware now that she's a white woman that has certain power and it has certain privilege and certain access, and that if she's not using it and trying to think of ways to use it to fight white supremacy, then kind of a part of the problem. She's not perfect. My mom makes big mistakes all the time, ones that confound me sometimes, mm-hmm. every time. But watching her engage with whiteness, mm-hmm. Is something that I think it means so much to me. You know, I don't need my mom to be my best friend who sits there and complains with me about how awful the world is right now. You know, what I need, and I think what so many other people need from white people, is for them to engage with whiteness and see how it functions in the world and start deconstructing that, mm-hmm. You know, and to watch her learn, go from telling me to my face, I'm not really white, you know, which is what she told me, to, oh, I'm this old white lady and I'm going to use the space. It's a lot of growth.
Yeah. It seems to me like the way you're describing the change from how she is now to say how you were as a child, it seems to me that, I guess when you were younger, you know, her whiteness is the default. She didn't see herself as a white person. She's just a person. Where, and in that mind frame, you can completely put that magnifying glass on black people. Black people are the entity to be studied. They're the thing that I can know, the thing that I can subsume. Whereas now, like, well, I'm an entity too. I'm raced as well, right?
Yes.
So to the point where she can try to figure out what that means and the privileges and I wouldn't even say responsibilities that comes with that. Yeah. But getting into your book, I think you said you started writing more about race when we had these litany of deaths by at the hands of police, the deaths of many a black man, black people in general, black men and women. I'm sure, you know, much ink has been put to paper over those kinds of events. But what was it about those events that made you want to write the kind of stuff about race that you did?
I would say for me, you know, a lot of it was I was living, you know, the Pacific Northwest. I don't know if you've ever been to Seattle.
I have not.
It is a place that loves to be right. It is a place that loves to be good. It loves to be on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Loves to recycle, cares about the environment. It loves to vote Democrat, right? It is vocally right about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up there. And for me personally, right, as a mother, as a black woman, as a sister, the death of Trayvon Martin hit me incredibly hard, right? This was also a time where my brother was on the road. He's a musician.
Mm-hmm.
My brother's a 6'6" black man.
Mm.
He often becomes a very visible target because of his size and his color and his gender. And he was traveling with a majority white band and finding himself in situations where he had never been in before, handcuffed for the first time, you know, all of these things. And he was, I think, not doing well emotionally. My brother and I are incredibly close, and I couldn't reach him. He wasn't answering his phone. He was traveling everywhere, and I was so worried about him. I was devastated what was happening. But then also, I just, in Seattle, no one was saying anything. No one was talking about these deaths.
Mm-hmm.
No one was talking about Trayvon. No one was saying a word. And, you know, if it happens, if it had been anything else, if you were to, you know, announce that a company wasn't recycling anymore, yeah, it would have been outrage, protest. People would have been sharing everything. But this, the murder of a boy, no one had anything to say. And I remember looking at people I grew up with and go to the office and people would talk about politics. Seattle's not a place where you don't talk politics at work. You talk politics 24/7. And no one would say anything. And I would ask about it. No one would say a word. And people would say, well, I don't really feel comfortable. I don't feel like it's my space. And so for me, for someone who grew up here, to hear people I've known for years who would, you know, say that I was like family to them, to see them have nothing to say about something that was impacting Black America, impacting me and my family, and was devastating. And so I really started writing because I was trying to figure out how such a highly educated, supposedly liberal, caring area,
mm-hmm,
two fucks,
mm-hmm,
about what was happening to Black
people. Yeah.
And I was like, well, maybe I'll try to explain it this way. What about this way? And I thought I was losing my mind because it would just be nothing, nothing. I lost probably over 80% of my friends, probably 90% of my friends when I started writing about race. And I think that, you know, for me, I was not thinking I'm going to be a writer. I wasn't writing, trying to publish anything. I didn't send anything out to be published. I was really just trying to get my community to actually see that we existed, that there were Black people in Seattle who needed to be seen and heard.
Mm-hmm.
And then it started getting picked up and people would ask if they could republish like a Facebook post. string of tweets, you know, or things like that. Like, that's really how it started. I wasn't pitching. I wasn't sending things out. I was literally just trying to get my community, you know, the greater Seattle community, to hear. And as I heard from other Black people in Seattle, they that was the only response I started was getting at first, where other Black people in Seattle being like, thank God you're saying something, because, like, I feel the same way. I feel like I'm losing my mind. And that's really kind of how it started for me.
Wow. There are two things that I noted from your description of what started you writing. Two things that I noted were, you lost 80% of your friends. And when these events were happening, no one was saying anything. Mm-hmm. And I found that really interesting, because you mentioned that, you know, they said they didn't feel comfortable speaking on that. That wasn't their area. But I find it peculiar. You know, I know in the Pacific Northwest, people are very vocal about LGBTQ issues, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I know this isn't too far-fetched to say, but I imagine you would have some people who aren't LGBTQ who, if something were to happen to somebody in that community, they would feel very comfortable about talking about it. But for some reason, when it comes to race, people have nothing to say. And I don't know, like, it makes me think that, and I was thinking about this recently, the country's age-old quote-unquote Negro problem. I feel like people want to make it passe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's already solved. We don't need to talk about that anymore. There are other groups who occupy the position that you guys occupied in the past. You guys have moved on. Wait, you had a president, you know, it's time to move on. The second thing I noticed was the, again, losing 80% of your friends. And I would have to ask you this, you know, was that, you know, what were the foundations of those friendships? Like, if you can talk about race and lose them, maybe those, the foundation of that, of those friendships were built on sand, you know? Of
like, oh, yeah. Somebody,
I've always said this, and I have very, very few white friends. And intellectually, knowing myself, how I think about race, and knowing the larger systemic problems and what people are willing and unwilling to do, there are times when I actually think white friends is simply those are opposing terms. That's like an oxymoron. It can't just particularly a Black man in this country. But my white friends are very few and far between, because my standards are very high.
Mm-hmm.
My standards are very high. So I don't know, just that really stuck out to me. Like you saying you lost 80% of your friends. Did any of them, were they vocal in telling you that, like, hey, this is why I can't kick it with you anymore, or this is why we can't hang out, or they just ghosted you?
I mean, most of them ghosted, but no, there were a couple that were very like, when did you become this militant? You know, these sorts of coded words. You sound like Al Sharpton. There are so many different compromises you have to make to live in a majority white environment if you want to pretend like you have friends. And I think for me, a lot of it, as I got older, my ability to make those compromises faded. And then you feel like you're suddenly renegotiating terms, right? And people who swore up and down they loved you to the end of the earth, you realize you weren't living as a whole person in your friendship with them. But you got so used to it, because literally it's what's expected of you all of the time in these areas. It is considered rude to talk about race in Seattle. And so you just don't talk about it. If you are one of the very few people of color and very few Black people, Seattle's about 6% Black in Seattle.
Wow.
You don't even have a group of Black people you can turn to. You know, there's only 6% of you. Our Black neighborhoods are being rapidly gentrified. So you don't even have like that, oh, I can hang out on the weekends, be my whole self. You start to lose yourself, because you never get a chance to engage with other people as a whole person. And it takes so much of you. And so that was part of why I said, like, it really was crazy making for me, like why I was so desperately writing, because I was realizing that all of my relationships, there was nothing there. These were lifelong relationships.
Wow.
There's nothing there. I have two white friends. Mm-hmm. Actually stuck through the whole thing. Tried so hard to like understand and engage. And I will love them forever because of that, because they were the only two. But I don't have a lot of white friends anymore. I don't have white people close to me at all anymore. And I tell a lot of young people who are in similar situations, especially when I go to universities, I get asked this a lot by, you know, Black college students. I think this is when it starts coming up for them more heavily. Is I just say, you know what? One thing I've learned is it is almost impossible to renegotiate the terms of friendship once they're set. So you have to show up in every relationship, even with white friends, no matter how much pressure, as your whole Black self. Mm-hmm. And not be willing to compromise any of that, no matter what. Even if they think that that's their definition of friendship, you have to hold fast, because you will not be able to go back 10 years later and say, this isn't okay anymore. And I was saying that, and that's where my friendships went. I don't have any regrets, you know? I'm very happy now, you know, and I know, like, the friendships, relationships I have. The relationships I have with white people have challenges, most definitely. But those ones I know I've been so clear, you know, and there's not a lot of people I let close or that I'm willing to expend that effort on. The rest of my relationships are with other people of color and permanently Black people. It's, you know, there are certain areas, there are certain things I don't think I could do again. I don't think I could be like in a romantic relationship with a white person ever again. Because I can't come home after doing this work and then have another person to try to explain this to. You know, like I can't. But, you know, I run into so many, when I run into Black people who grew up in Seattle, you do one or the other. Either you're completely isolated and alone and sad and kind of damaged, or if you were lucky to grow up in one of our few Black communities before they were dispersed. Like my partner grew up in that. It's amazing. It's like he had this alternate childhood where like he literally had to stay there. Like he didn't even come to the city the suburb I grew up in. Had never been there. Like, I don't know any of these people. I don't engage with this. These three blocks were my world, you know? And now that doesn't exist to me, right? Mm. But, you know, or I meet Black people who are just, have completely lost their sense of self, completely lost who they are. And they're the first ones lining up to tell me I'm too militant. First ones lining up to tell me I sound like Al Sharpton or I'm the real problem. And it's always heartbreaking.
You sound like Al Sharpton. So when somebody says something ignorant like that, it kind of makes me wonder, do they even know what Al Sharpton sounds like?
Oh, I doubt it.
So, anyway, you mentioned that's really interesting. You kind of transitioned into romantic relationships, because I kind of came to a conclusion about that a few years back that I could no longer do that myself. And it's because, you know, just having, you know, that extra burden of having to explain something with somebody you're supposed to be extremely intimate with. And if they don't get it, then how close are you really to them? Like I don't feel like you would necessarily feel close to them of knowing that they don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And when you say things like that, people want to hit you with all kinds of labels. and I think some of the people who are so willing to name call are some of the same people out there saying that just by having mixed race children is going to solve the race problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that ilk. But yeah, this is just very interesting to hear about the romantic relationships. I've often felt that, I guess in this era of where everybody is, you know, supposed to get along and, you know, see everybody for who they are. And when you have like legitimate reasons for not wanting to be in a relationship with somebody, I think you stick out like a sore thumb, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even when you have legitimate reasons, like I don't know if I feel comfortable. Like, you know, I don't want to have to come home from a hard day's work and, you know, I can't talk to my wife about being followed around in a store, or you know, going into a restaurant, the waiter can't look me in the eye. Which I experience a lot, by the way. I'm getting kind of tired of it. Actually, I made it my New Year's resolution this year to, if I experience that from a waiter in a restaurant now, like when we, me and my girlfriend in a restaurant now, and they decide to put all the focus on her, and act like I'm invisible. Yeah, I'm getting up and leaving. I'm not doing it anymore. I'm tired of that shit. But anyway, back to your book. One thing that really impressed me was, I think what you wrote on the version I have, it's like on page 111. And you talked about feeling lucky to be a writer, right? You talk about feeling lucky to be able to make your living as a writer at the, I guess at the age of, finally being able to make a living at the age of what, like 37, you said, I believe?
Yeah, I'm 38 now.
38 now, yes. What, I guess, what advice would you give for some, for someone going through the struggle of trying to gain some sort of literary notoriety?
I would say, and I'm giving this advice to Black people in particular, but other people of color, when I've said it, they've said it applies to them as well. One thing to is that, first off, we have the right to redefine language. We have the right to shape this country and our image as well. And you will hear a lot of gatekeepers in writing that your language needs to be a certain way. It needs to sound the way that white audiences are used to hearing it. You need to write in the way. No. What you have is your authenticity. And I would say that white America culturally has been tapped out. There are only so many different ways you can romanticize white American culture before it gets boring. It is boring. It has long been boring. Long been shown to be how to be insincere and lacking, because white America doesn't actually want to really look at itself, right? You can only do so many films and books about what it's like to be white in America without, when you're not actually looking at what it really is like to be white in America, it's tired. It's been tired for a long time. I think that right now, all of American culture, all of, like America in general, is kind of fatigued. They don't know what to trust. Sincerity shines. And I learned that as I started writing. I think I'm lucky in that I my background is in marketing. I learned about consistency of your brand before I even started writing. And so I kind of wrote with that instinct of, if I ever let anyone shape my voice who wasn't me, if I ever didn't sound like me, I was damaging my brand. And that's all I had as a Black woman, right? I didn't have the contacts, the connections, you know, I didn't have a journalism degree. I didn't have all these other things that, like, you know, I didn't have the internships and the access that many other people, white people entering into writing have. My honesty and my consistency. And I had, you know, I think kind of this, I have the inability to not speak my truth. You know, like I can't, I was always that person in meetings that made me uncomfortable all the time, you know, and I couldn't help it. Like I would just sit, you know, I was like, why? Why do we have a problem with this? Why can't I just say this thing? I don't understand why I can't just say this thing. So I would say, you know, when you're, when you first start out writing, editors will try to soften your voice. They'll try to make you less Black. They'll try to change your language. They'll try to get you to over-explain things as if an audience can't Google, as if they can't try to fill in the gaps. We fill in the gaps for white Americans in literature all the time. There's all sorts of shit I read where I'm like, that's completely foreign to me. I don't live that life, but I can fill in the gaps. I can, you know, I can tell from context clues what's happening. I believe that white America can't do that when it comes to Black culture. And they want us to serve up our entire lived experience in this, you know, on this very white platter. And don't do it. Resist it. Turn down whatever early gigs that ask you to do that. You have to be able to look at your work and recognize every word you write. Because what happens, the way in which every Black writer I know who's been able to make it work has been able to make it work because they have a consistent, they have a consistent voice, and it's theirs and it's authentic. And people find them. And people come to them. And when people start coming to you, when you have your consistent work that you're putting out there, wherever it can be found, you know, I was starting on Facebook, Twitter, right? Personal blogs. if it sounds like you, wherever you are, people will eventually start coming to you. They know they can always depend on you to have that voice. And then publishers come. And that's the way it worked for me. I wasn't sending stuff out to submit. I was writing and writing and writing and writing. And I was writing the same way because I had the same goal, right, all the time, which was to get people to, you know, to hear what it was like to be, you know, Black in this specific experience. You know what I mean? And I wasn't trying to get published, my voice always stayed the same. I wasn't trying to, you know, use words that I thought editors would like. I wasn't trying to do anything like that. And I just kept doing it time and time and time again. And then suddenly, you know, I'm getting more Facebook followers. Have a Facebook profile, have a Twitter profile. Make sure those names match the name you're writing with. That's a huge mistake writers make. A lot of times, especially writers of color, we don't feel safe writing with our names. So a lot of times we'll use pseudonyms, pen names, but then your Twitter has your name, your, you know, Instagram has a different name, your Facebook has a different name, and then you're building a writing following under a pseudonym. And then what? How are people supposed to find you? How are you supposed to share your work? How are they supposed to engage with you? So I was very sure. That's why everything I have is Ijoma Oluwo. Because I knew it was a hard enough name to learn. And if you went through the trouble to learn it, that's right. The only thing you have to learn if you're going to find me. And everywhere I go, it's consistent. But I know so many writers who build, they'll have a pen name. They'll build a following of like 5,000, you know, loyal readers. And then their Twitter is something else. And they'll try to share an article. And people are like, who's this? I don't know this person. So be consistent. Take back any piece from an editor that wants to ruin your voice. You know, work with editors, be professional, listen to them about maybe some style choices, about grammar, but don't let them make your language less Black. Don't let them soften, you know, anything that makes whiteness uncomfortable. Take those pieces back. I took back so many pieces when I first started writing. The moment an editor would be like, oh, well, this seems a bit mean, you know, could we maybe? And I'd be like, give it back. And I would forfeit that money and put it in places where I knew I could be heard. And eventually, you don't have to do that as much. But don't sign with anyone that's asking you to. Don't take jobs with people that are asking you to. And I know that's a really hard line that we shouldn't have to take. We should be able to take these early gigs, you know, if anything, for the learning experience. But mm-hmm. We have is our name and our consistency, our integrity. And just keep going. No other Black writers, get to know other Black artists in multiple fields. Some of the connections I made that have helped me the most were from like Black musicians, painters who also occupy this space. And we would talk and then someone would ask them, you know, I remember I did this whole speaking circuit on radio. I've never been on radio, but I got a call from actually the person who's now my partner. He works in radio and he's a musician. They asked him to do a gig. He didn't have any, but he was like, oh, I remember this writer, Ijoma. She's pretty good at speaking. You should reach out to her, right? No network within the Black community, not just in writing, but in all of the arts. Do favors for the Black community first. Always refer people for work if you can't do it. That will come back to you. And just, you know, live that whole truth. Like, live your Blackness every word you write. And if you are consistent and you don't make those early compromises, it will help you.
Okay. Yeah. That was much needed advice. I needed to hear myself, by the way. So,
good.
I guess I'm trying to figure out how to deal with criticism. As a writer, I recently wrote a piece for, I identify as a Black atheist. I'm an atheist and I'm Black. So I'm a Black atheist. Which is not, you know, it's not the most popular thing to be in our community.
It's not popular in the Black community or the atheist community.
I mean, yeah. or in America in general. But, I wrote a piece on, are you familiar with Pathos.com? Pathos? Yes. So I wrote a piece back in October for one of the blogs called Godless and Dixie. Mm-hmm. And it's ran by a former believer who's not an atheist. His name is Neil Carter. He lives in Mississippi. Jackson specifically, and I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got together with him, and I was like, "Yeah, I want to write this piece about. I want to write this piece about anti-intellectualism and its connection to the lack of atheism in Black America." And so that was a very interesting piece, and I spent a lot of time on it. I got a lot of pushback for it, as you can imagine, from religious folks, religious Black folks, and. But I got a lot of comments about how people, they were happy that they didn't feel alone.
Yeah.
And thinking this way. And I guess my question to you is, how do you, maybe you just have tough skin. I don't know, but how do you deal with the criticism of your work?
I would say, I have very thick skin. Why, whatever part of, like, I have, my sister-in-law's a writer, a really well-known writer. She reads every comment. It hits her personally. Mm-hmm. And I look at them, half of them, I'm like, whatever. I think for me, part of it is, and I tell a lot of writers this, and I have found writers with multiple New York Times bestsellers mm-hmm. get this. And I say it to them, and they're like, oh, wow, I totally forgot this. You have every right to define who your audience is. Define who your audience is.
Right.
Know who your audience is. That is who you are accountable for.
It's funny that you say that. Sorry to interrupt you. It's funny that you say that because as much as the criticism hurts, I'm very thin-skinned. And as much as the criticism hurts me, and in a larger sense, I have to tell myself, like, everything is not for everybody.
Exactly.
And I have to keep reminding myself of that.
Really, the world is vast.
Yeah.
Internet is vast. I think that you do your reader a disservice by not knowing who your audience is and writing to them. And that means that, you know, like, I'll get a ton of comments and I'm like, oh, I wasn't even writing to you. I knew you were like this. Let that go, right? And people try to act like if you write something, you have to make it for. They'll try to pick out, nitpick, and say, you didn't get this point, you didn't get this point, you didn't get this point.
Right.
Be honest with yourself about who your audience is. Know who your audience is. Be loyal to them. That means also listen to feedback from them, right? If they're saying this is harming us, listen to that. But know who your audience is, your audience. Not, and sometimes it's different, right? Sometimes it's not going to be, but like when you sit and imagine who would benefit from this piece, that's who you write to. And that's who you listen to. And that's the feedback that matters. And you let the rest go. You have to. And know that if they want a piece that's going to address this aspect and this aspect, someone else will come along and write that and will write it better than you would because that's not your audience. And you just have to let that go.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think that everyone thinks that, especially in the internet age, that everything you write is an invitation to debate. It's not. Mm-hmm. What you write may be a piece of a larger debate, but that's it. Piece. You don't have to re-engage it. You don't have to continue it. If someone wants to make a follow-up point, they are welcome to go ahead and start their own blog and write their own essay. Part of a broader debate that is not you engaging back and forth with every person that disagrees with you. You adding your voice into what hopefully responsible people will read in the many things they're reading about a topic that they care about. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Mm-hmm. I guess because I do want to let you enjoy your afternoon, I guess one of the last things I want to ask you is and it's the most, I guess, basic question I can ask about the book. But it's also about your writing as well. What exactly are you trying to articulate in writing a book like So You Want to Talk About Race and the numerous articles that you've written for, like, the Guardian or, what is it, the, I believe you written for The Stranger, correct? In Seattle?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Things like that. What is exactly is a central theme or motif that you're trying to get across in writing about this stuff?
What I'm trying to get across to people, and first and foremost, I think I find myself arguing more than anything, is that your intentions don't mean shit.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to race, people want 100% credit for their intentions, no credit whatsoever for the impact of their actions. I'm trying to get people more than anything to see they are a part of a system that does harm. To get white people to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And that they are responsible for how they act within that system and how they interact with that system, no matter how aware they are or not. So for me, a lot of my writing, almost all of my writing, is born out of frustration of people just not seeing the very basics of how the system works that they're talking about. You know, my whole book was so frustrating to hear people getting these knockdown, drag out fights about terms that they didn't even understand, right? Like, hear people go, oh, no, I'm like, what are you even talking about? It's not even what that word means. What do you mean? You know, and understand that there's a system at play and that you are responsible for how you interact with it, and that Black people and people of color are being crushed by that system. And that's real and it matters. And so that's really what I want. I want to take race out of the, am I going to have friends of color, you know, or am I going to be best friends with white people? And are we going to start taking down this system that is harming people of color every day,
mm-hmm.
in a very measurable way? And that's really what I want people to get. And so when I see all these arguments about things that happen, whether it's people in Starbucks or all this stuff, and it becomes all about, did she mean to? Do you know what she intended? You know what they feel? That's where so much of my writing is getting people to say, I don't care what you felt. I don't care how sorry you feel. I don't care how bad you feel. What I care about is that you are in this system. You interacted this way. You caused this harm or you reinforced this harm. And now you know, and you have to be different. You have to do better. And that Black people and people of color in America have every right to be hurt and angry and scared and tired for the way in which this system has crushed them and the way in which white America has refused to accept responsibility, how they interact with the system.
So essentially going from the interpersonal to the systematic.
Right? Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to let you go. I definitely appreciate you joining me. It's been 8 months waiting, yes. But it finally happened. It finally happened. And I was persistent. I'm glad about it.
Thank you. I appreciate your persistence because I'm incredibly difficult to pin down. Mm. And when I tell people I want to do something, I honestly mean it.
Mm.
But there's nothing I want to do less than ever answer any emails. So I'm glad that you were persistent. We got it worked out. And I've been traveling so much. Thank you. Because I really enjoyed this conversation. Mm.
And can you tell people how to get, how can they keep up with what you're doing lately and any new projects? Yeah.
Twitter and Facebook are kind of where I'm at. Mm-hmm. I am much quieter right now writing-wise because I am writing my next book, which is due in May. So, and I'm very far behind. So I'm trying to focus on that. I have a film coming out in May as well. But you can find me, Ijoma Oluo. If you just Google Ijoma Oluo, you're going to find me in every space like that. Everything is under that name.
All right. Miss Ijoma Oluo. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.